This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and today I want to go back to the year 1791. That is the year that the United States of America ratified the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution, confirming some fundamental rights to the citizens, including the freedom of religion. Fast forward to 1968, and that is when President Lyndon Johnson signed the Indian Civil Rights Act, which granted many Native American tribes the benefits that are included in the Bill of Rights, including the right to their own religious practices. And within those religious practices comes how we honor our dead. The Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, or NAGPRA, is a law that establishes the ownership of cultural items excavated or discovered on federal or tribal land after November 16, 1990. It requires federal agencies and institutions that get federal funding to return Native American cultural items to lineal descendants. Yankton Dakota activist Running Moccasins, more commonly known by her colonized name of Maria Pearson, was one of the catalysts for NAGPRA after discovering that bones of white people and bones of indigenous people were treated very differently after being uncovered during road construction. The remains of the white people were reburied. The remains of the indigenous people were sent to a lab to be studied. Today we are going to talk with Dr. Philip DeLoria. He is a professor of history at Harvard, and his focus is on cultural and political histories of the relations of American Indian peoples and the United States. He'll be presenting on the three main phases of NAGPRA tonight for Humanities ND at 7 p.m. Central. Dr. DeLoria, thank you so much for your time today.
It's my great pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
The definition of the North American Graves Protection Act, as you might expect from anything written into a legal document, is complex. How do you understand this law?
It's a great question. I mean, my first and primary understanding of the law is that it is a moral and ethical kind of issue, that it is driven and centered in those kinds of concerns. And in that sense, it's a law that has been to the service of, but also difficult, challenging, and problematic for Native people in particular. But I think it's the sort of moral claim that Native folks have on the United States that really sits at the center of the law. Everything else on top of it is law and administrative kind of work, as you sort of mentioned.
Yeah, difficult, challenging, problematic. Those are three, pretty tough-sounding words when we talk about how to navigate an issue as complex as this. So I want to start even with who has the burden of proof when it comes to determining who the remains belong to.
Well, it's one of the things that's really interesting as part of the administrative kind of aspects of NAGPRA, right? That NAGPRA is trying to thread the needle between what I think is an ironclad moral claim of Native people on their cultural patrimony, their sacred objects, their human remains, and their funerary objects. But how do you implement that? And how do you figure out what happens? So, the way the process works, is that museums and institutions basically adjudicate the claim that Native people bring to them. And so there's a sort of baked in conflict of interest, that is part of the structure of the law. You know, one might imagine a neutral third party sort of making kinds of determinations. On the other hand, one of the things that NAGPRA has really accomplished, I think, has been a set of partnerships and collaborations and new possibilities between these institutions, which are here to stay and not going away. Museums, universities, these are important kinds of institutions. They actually do good work. Mm-hmm. The more that we can imagine collaboration with tribal partners, and NAGPRA has actually been a sort of central venue for creating relationships that just hadn't existed before. So the slowness and the cumbersome nature of the process, you know, I think also has what one would have imagined as sort of unexpected benefits, you know, back in 1990 when the law was passed.
I want to talk about that word partnership that you just used. You're a trustee of the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of the American Indian. You also used the phrase ironclad. They have an ironclad moral right to the bones of their ancestors. And so often you hear this argument in academic circles that we have this scientific interest in these bones and not ever trying to look at it from this cultural perspective of these belong to a human and a people group that for the most part hasn't been people making these decisions, making these laws. As your approach now in that role, how do you tackle that issue of the scientific interest of learning, of studying, and also being deeply respectful of a culture, and specifically a culture's dead?
You know, I think this is one of these places where, you know, I use the word partnership or collaboration, where there's a fair amount of, unevenness. And I think if we take tribal sovereignty as a serious thing, as I do, as we do in Indian country, we also have to leave room for the fact that some tribes may be interested in the kinds of scientific studies, that folks have wanted to carry on. I'd say the majority are not. There's an odd juxtaposition, right, between, you mentioned I use this phrase, the ironclad moral claim. There's a bit of a juxtaposition between that and the desires of different kinds of tribal nations to do different kinds of things. NMAI, the Museum of the American Indian, is I think, a particularly special case. Mm-hmm. The museum has been led by Native people from its inception. The sort of unwritten and then later formalized kind of policy initiative there, the sort of thrust of this was that the NMAI should have no human remains in its collection. Mm-hmm. And over time, the museum has moved quite far down the road to that. The human remains that still remain in that collection tend to fall into a couple categories. They're things that tribes and tribal nations do not want to have and have said explicitly, we would like you to caretake these. And so this is sort of honoring those wishes and desires. Things that are so completely complicated that they just take a long time and they have been pushed to the end of the line. One of the things the NMAI did early on, well, perhaps not early on, but medium on, was to try to deal with the category of, you know, what are called unidentified or unidentifiable human remains that, and in NMAI's collection had unidentifiable human remains that were not native, but we partnered with tribal nations to accept, repatriate, and care for those human remains. And so basically cleared out an entire category that the museum held, that has been a challenge for other museums. What we're now looking at NMAI is international repatriations, things that don't fall under NAGPRA, or in our case, case of that museum, the Museum Enabling Act, which is not the same thing as NAGPRA, but, kind of functions in a similar, similar kind of way. And applies to all the Smithsonians, actually. The Smithsonians don't fall under NAGPRA. They fall under the NMAI Enabling Act. And international repatriations, you know, as you might imagine, have their own kinds of complexities and layers of complexities, in part because you may be dealing with local communities. You're not necessarily dealing with sort of federally recognized tribes, as in the United States, the American context. And you're dealing with, foreign nations and international kinds of diplomatic sorts of relationships, and it gets incredibly complicated, among those kinds of stakeholders.
There's a somewhat famous case. They call him the Kennewick Man, and multiple people groups lay claim to him as an ancestor, among them the Nez Perce and the Yakima. Do you know what happens in the event of when there might be a mixed tribal affiliation?
What most institutions do, and I think it's the right thing to do, is, you know, an institution does not make a decision among multiple tribal stakeholders, right? Okay. You defer that back to those tribal stakeholders and, you know, allow them to work through their own, you know, processes and practices of diplomacy to figure out, you know, what the relationship is going to be. And what happens a lot of times is, you know, sometimes you have formal tribal consortiums, MACPRA in Michigan, for example, which is, you know, an Anishinaabe groups sort of working together in a consortium kind of strategy. Southeastern tribes have consortia as well. You know, so sometimes this ends up being a quite structured sort of process among tribal nations. Other times, though, it's very case specific. And, you know, the institution basically pushes the question back rightly to self-determining sovereign tribal nations to work those things out among, you know, among themselves. That can add a lot of time and a lot of energy, you know, to the process. Sometimes things which look like they ought to be easy and obvious end up being complicated around exactly this, you know, this kind of vector. But I think it's a recognition of tribal sovereignty to do that as opposed to the institution, you know, making some kind of determination. That would just not be the right thing to do.
Realizing that certain aspects of sacred ceremony stay sacred by not being talked about, I wonder if I can ask you, do you know of protocols? And I of course, won't ask you to speak on behalf of all of Indian country. I know that there are, you know, more than 570
Thanks.
Federally recognized tribes, trying to have one person speak on behalf of all of them is a ridiculous notion. But this idea, too, that there can be remains that are found sometimes hundreds of years after the death, or they have been in a museum, and a culture's funeral rites, you know, they are sometimes day of, sometimes 3 days later. I'm wondering, is there protocol in place for honoring these ancestors who have taken this extra long way home?
This is one of the things that I think is most important and oftentimes most moving, you know, for those of us who are involved in NAGPRA. And, you know, and for me, my involvement has not been on the tribal side. You know, there are folks, Eric Hemingway, who, for example, is going to be part of our conversation later today, you know, who's been on the tribal side. I've always been on the institutional side as a sort of, you know, trying to represent Native voice within institutions. But the answer is that there are absolutely a whole series and a wide variety of things. I think these remains have taken on, and I think rightly, a real significance, spiritual significance, cultural and social significance, you know, aside from their political significance, which is also, you know, an aspect of this. When tribal nations come and representatives come to an institution to actually affect, you know, the material transfer that is part of repatriation, you know, it is almost always, in every instance I've seen or experienced, it is a serious and solemn and spiritual and deeply moving kind of experience to reunite people with their ancestors who have been separated, you know, as you say, sometimes for hundreds of years or more, you know, you know, so institutions have increasingly tried to create spaces for that. You know, at the NMAI, there's a, you know, an entire room, there's outdoor space, there is spaces, you know, for ceremony, you know, oftentimes that involves smudging, institutions, as you can imagine, who are concerned about climate control and things like that are not very interested in smoke being in their space. But institutions have had to accommodate these kinds of things, right, in order to allow Native folks who are coming to reclaim the remains of their ancestors, to do it in a proper ceremonial, you know, kind of way. So this has become, I think, a really important part of this. And it's, as I say, it's deeply, deeply meaningful.
I'm wondering, with so many recent news stories talking about unearthing hundreds of bodies worth of bones, so often the youngest among us, in part of this boarding school era where children were kidnapped from their homes. They were sent to these schools. They were often horrendously abused and very often died at the hands of missionaries and other people in charge of these schools. Is there, when you talk about finding so many of this all at once, can you talk about how that makes this even more problematic and complex of a topic, but also increasingly more important and timely?
In the years since NAGPRA, was passed, basically the implementation of the law has sort of fallen around three different kinds of sets of human remains. The first is, the most egregious, and that is the sort of racial science kind of collecting of human remains that took place in the 19th century, when we think about army officers and military surgeons taking bodies off of battlefields, digging up recent graves, sending these things back to Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia. This is what we're talking about. There's a second context, which is really about the archaeological context, as, you know, large archaeology expeditions went out and started, you know, digging in different kinds of places. Sometimes those folks were digging up actual graveyards and cemeteries. Sometimes they were digging up, other more scattered kinds of human remains. The third category was really things that were uncovered in the moment, as someone's digging up a foundation for a building or building a highway or things like that. The boarding school conversation, which has been so important in Native country in terms of thinking about culture and language, has now been joined to the NAGPRA conversation. And I think the joining of those two things together is one of the most important sort of aspects of NAGPRA that's happened now. So when we imagine boarding schools, Native folks who, have ancestors in boarding schools, I think always knew, right, that these schools, killed a lot of kids. It wasn't just the sort of killing of culture. It was that children actually died there. And what happened to those children? So often they never made their way back home. And now what we're seeing is the actual result of that, right? These cemeteries, these unmarked graves, unmarked cemeteries, and the sort of revelation, which I think is not a revelation to Native folks, but is a revelation to others who are thinking about the boarding school context, that in fact now we have a new way that we have to be thinking about repatriation, in this different, different kind of context.
Yeah, I'm curious why the platform of this Zoom conversation for Humanities ND. How does that advance this conversation?
Right. Well, I think NAGPRA, NAGPRA is a legal and therefore political and diplomatic kind of process. But I think that the moral and ethical kinds of issues really have much to say for people who are interested in the humanities as we contemplate philosophical, metaphysical kinds of issues and questions. So often what the administrative aspect of NAGPRA throws up for us is deep and serious ethical kinds of issues. How do we think about this? It feels like the administration of the law should be relatively straightforward. I think if anyone who's done cases, repatriation cases, comes to understand relatively quickly, almost immediately, there are really complicated kinds of ethical sorts of issues. What happens when you have lineal descendants who have a claim that runs against a sort of tribal collective sort of claim? How do you navigate, among different kinds of tribes? What happens when tribes say that, they don't actually want to be repatriate their human remains, and then the institution, has an obligation of care? How do you deal with an international context in which, a nation state wants to claim indigenous remains and put them in a museum in order to, construct a nationalist kind of narrative that runs against the grain of what we would in the United States see as tribal sovereign and local community kinds of things? How do you deal with human remains that were of one tribal nation, but which passed into the ownership of another tribal nation as scalp locks, right? So the minute you start diving into these things, you find ethical kinds of questions. And to me, putting that in a humanities kind of platform, is a perfect and complicated way. It is the place to think about complicated sorts of issues such as this.
Do you feel like in the years that you have been working with this, that there is an increased understanding from the white culture that the ethical and moral considerations that have not been taken in terms of using remains as exclusively scientific research, if that, sometimes they're just left, and making sure that there are indigenous people who are being involved in these conversations?
I think this has gotten better and better over the last three decades of NAGPRA. We're clearly not where we want to be or need to be. But tribes over the last three decades have built, oftentimes rather extraordinary capacity for thinking about and dealing with these administrative sorts of issues. And they did it from scratch, as they had to. Museums, had to also build an infrastructure from scratch, beginning in 1990. That first decade was, I think, not an easy one for anyone. And things have been increasingly complicated ever since, but I think the partnerships, the collaborations, and I think the awareness on the part of museums has gotten better. The Harvard Museum and the other place I'm really associated with doing a lot of repatriation work is the Harvard Peabody Museum, and I've only been at Harvard for, I'm just starting my fourth year. So, this is a new sort of initiative, for me and for Harvard. But what I've seen is an institution that, has held many, many, many human remains, thousands of indigenous human remains. But in the last 4 years, right, we have Native folks. We have an oversight committee that's brand new. We have Native folks on that committee. We have, concerned ethical archaeologists on that committee. We have, a new director of the museum who is completely immersed in the ethical kinds of issues around NAGPRA and around sort of doing things right and doing things better. So it's Harvard comes in, takes a lot of, a lot of heat, rightly so, for its long history of collections. And it's a place where collections sort of funneled up into Harvard, which makes makes it a very large holder. But what I've seen over the last 4 years here, for example, has been, almost entirely positive. And it's not just a few people who are committed to this work, right? It's been support, at larger and higher institutional kinds of levels. So I think institutions have definitely gotten better. The discourse has changed over the years. In the sort of first decade, first 15 years of NAGPRA, there was a lot of talk about the balance between science and archaeology and Native claims. And some of that balance language just doesn't really fly much anymore. Even archaeologists are saying, we used to say balance 15 years ago, and now we kind of don't really say that anymore. We're trying to think about a new ethical archaeology. I think NAGPRA and institutional partnerships around those things have pushed archaeologists further and further towards this claim on a more ethical archaeology. So I think it has been beneficial. It's slow. There's no doubt about that, and it's frustrating. But on the whole, I grade NAGPRA as a positive thing rather than a negative thing.
Dr. Deloria, thank you so much for your time today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Harvard Professor of History, Dr. Philip Deloria, presenting tonight via Zoom for Humanities ND at 7 p.m. Central on the history of the North American Graves Protection Act and boarding school repatriation. You can find out how to attend this free event at humanitiesnd.org. There's more Main Street after this news.
Good afternoon from the Prairie Public Newsroom. I'm Todd McDonald. Volunteers will be heading out tomorrow evening to conduct the point-in-time homelessness survey. Sean L. Willer is coordinator with North Dakota Continuum of Care.
HUD requires continuum of cares across the nation to conduct a count in January to get a one-night snapshot of what homelessness looks like across the nation.
Willer says not only does the count give HUD a look at the homeless population in a state, it also gets word out that assistance is available to those in need.
There's two pieces to this count. There is the sheltered count, but then there's also an unsheltered count. And so what we do is for the unsheltered count, we go out into the communities and do outreach and try to find those individuals that are sleeping outside in the winter and then try to connect them with resources that are available in their area.
Willer says while metropolitan areas like Bismarck, Fargo, and Grand Forks may have a service network in place, the challenge increases when it comes to more rural areas of North Dakota. Willer says we know there are homeless individuals and families in North Dakota. The goal is to connect with them and let them know there is assistance available. Minnesota House Democrats have put forth a $100 million proposal to improve public safety across the state. It includes grant money for community policing, law enforcement investigations, and for nonprofits working on violence prevention. DFL Representative Cedric Frazier of New Hope says new resolutions are needed to address rising crime.
We know that responding to this national crisis by blaming politicians, demonizing certain parts of our state, or defunding prosecutors, as some of my GOP colleagues have proposed, will not solve anything. This only requires new solutions, not old politics.
A House committee plans to hold hearings during the legislative session. That begins next week. And the Grand Forks Police Department has come up with a plan to donate car number 13 to the Law Enforcement Museum at Bonanzaville in West Fargo. The squad was driven by Cody Holte and is scheduled to be taken out of service this year. Holte was killed in a shootout in South Grand Forks, May 2020. Police Chief Mark Nelson says the department will offset lost costs through a trade-in on a new vehicle by tapping a $15,000 donation from End of Watch Ride. Nelson says the money is designed to honor fallen officers. The Grand Forks City Council has given preliminary approval to the idea. For Prairie Public, I'm Todd McDonald.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. A recent study by the Pew Research Center shows that 3 of 10 U.S. adults are religiously unaffiliated. Greg Smith is the Associate Director of Research for the center, and he recently visited with Lori Walsh, host of In the Moment from South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Greg, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
For people not familiar with Pew, tell me a little bit about the work that you do, its bipartisan nature, and really how you get at some of these survey results.
Sure. Pew Research Center is a nonpartisan, non-advocacy research organization. So what that means in practice is that we are non-political, we don't endorse candidates for office, and importantly, with respect to religion, we don't endorse any particular religious belief or non-belief. Rather, our mission, our goal, the thing we try really hard to do is to provide an objective source of facts that people interested in religious trends or other societal trends can use to really understand what's happening in the world around them.
How has the pandemic impacted your research and your ability to do that? Are you measuring an impact of that on a survey such as this one about religion in the United States?
You know, we've been able to continue doing our research. We at Pew Research Center, like so many people around the country, are working remotely, but we have been able to continue to interview Americans mainly online and by mail and ask them about their experiences, about their religious attributes, and even about their experiences with the pandemic. And We have found, probably not surprisingly, a big impact of the pandemic on the way people lead their religious lives. We've been able to track, for example, that as things with the pandemic got worse in 2020, people stopped attending in-person religious services and switched mostly to attending or participating in services online. As things got better with the pandemic, as the situation improved, we saw sort of a gradual return to normal, never getting all the way back to normal, but a return to normal in terms of people's comfort level with attending in-person services. And we're hoping to continue to monitor these things moving forward. I'm not sure what this latest surge of the pandemic has done on in-person trends, but it's definitely something we'll monitor going forward.
I'm going to make an assumption and say it's a bit too early to measure what the trend would be on loss of life as far as like how many people who were religiously affiliated died versus non-affiliated. It's probably too soon to really look at something like that. Am I correct there?
Yes, it's definitely too soon, and I'm not sure, and I mean that literally, you know, thinking about this from a social scientific perspective, I'm not sure how the numbers that we're seeing in terms of those who've lost their lives or those who've been sickened might carry over into some of these aggregate level trends. But that said, yes, I think it's definitely too soon.
Yeah.
One thing we do know for sure is that older Americans on average tend to be quite a bit more religiously observant than younger Americans, and to the extent that older Americans have experienced more severe illness, higher rates of death from the virus, I could certainly see, at least in theory, that carrying over to some of these religious trends.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about the trend for the religiously affiliated. What are we seeing about how many people say, I'm not really affiliated with any church or religion?
Yeah. What we see in our most recent data is that the secularizing shifts that have been underway in American life for decades now, those secularizing shifts, they show no signs of slowing, no signs of changing. The percentage of American adults who say they have no religion, when we ask them about their religious identity, are you Christian, Jewish, Muslim, something else, the percentage of Americans who say they have no religion continues to grow. It now stands at 29%. Meanwhile, the share of Americans who describe themselves as Christians continues to fall. Most Americans still do identify as Christians, but that number is declining.
Within Christianity, where is the decline?
Within Christianity, the decline is most concentrated within Protestantism. People who identify as Baptist or Lutheran or Presbyterian or Methodist, the share of Americans who describe themselves as Protestants today stands at 40%. That's down 10 percentage points over the last 10 years. So there have been real significant, really noticeable declines in the share of Americans who identify as Protestants. By contrast, the other very large Christian group in the United States, Catholicism, the Catholic share of the population has held quite stable. We did pick up a little bit of a downturn in the Catholic share of the population about a decade ago, between 2007 and 2014, let's say. But over the last 5 to 7 years, the Catholic share of the population has been quite steady. Today, about 1 in 5 Americans, 21%, describe themselves as Catholics.
And this is fascinating to me, this idea of people who think of themselves as born again or evangelical Christian. Help us understand, of those Protestants, people who identify as Protestant, how many of them also say they're evangelical or born again?
Yes, you know, we get asked a lot about what's happening within evangelical Protestantism in the United States. People,
yeah,
especially people interested in religion and politics, they care a lot about what's happening with evangelical Protestantism. What these data show, as I mentioned, is that the Protestant share of the population as a whole is declining. But within Protestantism, we see that self-described born-again evangelical Christians continue to outnumber Protestants who don't think of themselves as born-again or evangelical Christians. Today, about 6 in 10 Protestants say yes when we ask them, do you think of yourself as a born-again or evangelical Christian, while 4 in 10 say no, they do not. So there are fewer self-described evangelical Protestants in the U.S. population as a share of the percentage today than in previous years. But that's because there are fewer Protestants as a whole. It's not because Protestants are leaving evangelicalism.
Interesting. I want to go back to the behavior. We talked a little bit about how people adjusted their behavior during the pandemic. But broadly speaking, when we think about religious affiliation, we think about certain behaviors. What did you find about how many adults are engaged in daily prayer, for example?
Yeah, frequency of daily prayer is the best measure that we have a long-term trend on. Today, fewer than half of U.S. adults, 45%, tell us that they pray every day, at least once a day. Many people say they pray more often than that. To put that number in comparison, when we first asked this question almost 15 years ago, back in 2007, 58% of American adults told us that they pray every day. So over that period of time, we've seen a 13-point decline in the share of Americans who say they pray every day. Over that same period of time, the share of Americans who say they seldom or never pray has gone up. And today, about one-third of U.S. adults say they seldom or never pray.
Hmm. And how many are attending religious services? How many of are actually gathering with other people in their faiths? This is Christian and non-Christian as well. It's Christians, Jews, Muslims,
yes,
others. Yeah.
Yes, we asked people a broad question about religious attendance that applies to both Christians and people from other faiths. Mm-hmm. Aside from weddings and funerals, how often do you attend religious services? And today we're finding that about 3 in 10 U.S. adults say they attend religious services regularly, at least once a month or more often, and that includes about a quarter of U.S. adults, 25%, who tell us that they attend religious services weekly. Unfortunately, for a variety of methodological reasons, we don't have a long-term trend on rates of religious attendance, but that's what we're seeing most recently.
One more question, Greg, and that is, you know, how often, you know, as you measure these trends, how often are you getting new data and looking at the direction those trends are going? When do we learn more, in other words?
We try to do this regularly, I would say at least on an annual basis. You know, some of these questions we ask more often than others. We ask people about their religious identity. Are you Protestant, Catholic, Mormon, Jewish, something else? We ask that question most regularly. But we try to ask these other questions often as well, at least annually, so that we can keep a close eye on how these trends are developing.
Yeah. Any other surprises from the data that you found that you think are worth sharing before we let you go?
I think maybe one other thing that comes to my mind is just another example of these secularizing trends is that just as we've seen declines in the share of Americans who identify with a religion, declines in the share of Americans who say they pray regularly, we're also seeing declines in the share of Americans who say religion is very important in their lives. Today, that number stands at about 4 in 10 U.S. adults who say religion is very important to them. That number, like so many other indicators of religiousness, has been trending downward over time.
Greg Smith is Associate Director of Research at the Pew Research Center. Thank you so much for this update. We appreciate your time.
Thank you again for having me. Great to be with you.
And he was visiting with Lori Walsh, the host of In the Moment from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Dakota Datebook is next.
The Spirit Room continues to celebrate the book An American Sunrise, 6:30, February 7th, with a performance by Joy Harjo, America's first Native American poet laureate, funded by a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts Big Read event. Related workshops, an art exhibition, and book discussions are also supported by the North Dakota Humanities Council. Copies of Harjo's book, along with event programs, are available at the Downtown Fargo Public Library, Spirit Room, Zambros, and Plains Art Museum. All events are open to the public.
Phone bill, credit card bill, gym bill, advertisement from AARP. Oh, that scooter does look kind of nice, actually. I never get any mail I want. No fan mail from Ari Shapiro. No postcards. Nobody even thinks about me anymore. Oh, I'm a middle child. They never did. Wait, what's this? It's a sleek silver box with a purple ribbon and a little note. And oh, what delicate morsels lie inside? Why, it's cocoa truffles from Nicole's fine pastry and a sweet little love poem from my sweetheart. I didn't even know my cat could write poetry. I'm melting on a cold February day.
Relive the thrill of getting something good in the mail. Become a member of Prairie Public for as little as $10 a month, and we'll send a box of Nicole's Fine Pastries Cocoa Truffles to anywhere in the continental U.S. in time for Valentine's Day. Go to prairiepublic.org or call 800-359-4145.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 25th. On this date in 1911, the Bismarck Daily Tribune ran a small ad requesting readers to submit historical material, including pioneer letters, stories, and diaries, to the State Historical Society. Today it's known as the State Historical Society of North Dakota. It was preceded by earlier groups. The Old Settlers Historical Association was approved by the Legislative Assembly of Dakota Territory in 1862. Membership in this organization was limited to people who lived in the region before the territory's creation. In 1863, the Old Settlers Association was replaced by the Historical Society of Dakota. In 1889, the Ladies Historical Society was established for women who lived in Bismarck prior to 1873, and in 1894, it was renamed the North Dakota Historical Society and embraced a statewide focus. The state legislature created the Historical Commission in 1895 and provided space in the Capitol for its collections. It wasn't until 1903 that the state provided funds to support the commission. That year, the North Dakota Historical Society changed the name to the State Historical Society of North Dakota. The first secretary for the society was Orrin G. Libby, a history professor at the University of North Dakota. He revitalized the society and was an integral figure for several decades. The Historical Commission was disbanded in 1905, and a board of directors was named for the Historical Society. By 1911, when the ad appeared in the Bismarck Tribune, the society was authorized to accept items on behalf of the state. It grew steadily, acquiring historic sites and state parks. Under Libby's guidance, the society began publishing the North Dakota Historical Quarterly in 1826. 10 years later, the State Parks Commission was established to help oversee historic sites. Today, the State Historical Society is responsible for preserving and interpreting historical sites and artifacts, and maintains the museum in the North Dakota Heritage Center. The Society maintains 59 historic sites from Fort Abercrombie in the east to the Missouri-Yellowstone Confluence Interpretive Center on the western border. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Hey, teachers! Prairie Public Education Services is collaborating with the North Dakota Council of Teachers of English this spring on a virtual professional development course called Growing Together. The course will focus on collaborative lesson development and practical tools and tips on classroom media for teachers of all subjects. Visit prairiepublic.org/education/NDCTE to sign up before the February 1st deadline.
Thousands of federal inmates are being released this month thanks to the First Step Act.
We will start to see more prisoners get out early. My concern is that the color of their skin will not be reflective of fairness.
Why a tool designed to help gauge which inmates are ready is flawed and may be putting people of color at a disadvantage. On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we get a preview of the upcoming season of Prairie Musicians with Prairie Public production manager Barb Gravel. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Right now, it's All Things Considered.